If ever there was a story to make us get off our backsides, to not only walk on in life, but to live life to the max, it's that of Liverpool-born and real-life war hero Andy Grant. Aged just 12, he was forced to face a life without his beloved mum, who passed away from leukaemia. And finding himself in a rut at 16, he saw an advert for the Royal Marines that changed his life forever. Knowing he wanted to make his mum proud and falling in love with the notion of belonging to an elite band of brothers, at just 17, Andy successfully became the exception to the Royal Marine rule that 99.9% need not apply. After active service in Iraq at age 20, Andy was posted to Afghanistan, where, whilst on patrol, he was blown up, suffering horrific injuries. And at just 22, he made the life-changing and agonising decision to have his leg amputated below the knee. But that was just the beginning of Andy's story. Not only did he face the challenge of having to learn to walk again, he has gone on to become a world record holder as the fastest single leg amputee over 10 kilometres, a double gold medal winner at Prince Harry's Invictus Games, and as well as running marathons, learning to ski and surf and climb the highest of mountains, Andy is now currently in training for one of the hardest ultra marathons in the world, the Marathon de Sable. As a motivational speaker, Andy inspires people of all ages. He has his own successful The Leg It podcast, and despite being told he could never have children, he is the proud father of his beautiful daughter, Alba. His story is documented in his superbly titled book, You'll Never Walk, and there is another story behind that book title, which you definitely need to hear, so please do listen. I know my conversation with him is going to inspire us all. So let's talk on to Walk On with Andy Grant and let's see where it leads. Andy, welcome to Talk On to Walk On. We got you here eventually. I know you're a busy guy, so I do really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us to share your story. Very quickly, I just want to just introduce the book. Here we go. You'll Never Walk. I've got the original hard copy.
That's when you know you're a proper fan, when you've got the hard copy.
There'll be little notes in there. But to be honest, I could have marked every single page. So a little quick promo for your book, brilliant story, brilliantly co-written or ghostwritten with Phil Reed.
Ghostwritten, yeah.
Yeah, over you telling your story over a pint of Marboils. I love that image.
Yeah. Great. Very therapeutic. It was the kind of therapy I didn't think I needed, but it was brilliant, yeah.
Well, yeah, that which is a great point to start off on, actually, because the backbone of Talk On to Walk On, what we tend to do is with the live chat, is we do people's stories, but I tend to hone in on moments when they've had conversations with somebody that has had a big impact on their life or a conversation they've had to say to themselves to walk on and move forward. Your book is absolutely littered with them. But before we get into that, I wanted to sort of applaud you. And what I loved particularly about the book is the hardest thing that has happened to you in your life is the loss of your mum when you were 12. And I just wanted to you to just explain how that has shaped you and how your family are the backbone and even your mum, even still to this day, impacts you in your life.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like I say, I was 12 and I lost my mum and I was a real mummy's boy. You know, I'd get sent to shops for some kind of bread and milk and I'd be saying, you know, love you, mum. And, you know, my dad would be saying, bloody hell, you only go in the shop. But I was kind of such a mummy's boy of always telling her I loved her 100 times a day. And wow. When she passed away when I was 12, you know, it was massive. It's had a bigger impact on me than, you know, during the Marines, Iraq, Afghanistan. You know, it shaped my whole behaviour, my whole being, my attitude, my views on life. And yet it was... yeah, without doubt, the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. And I think, like you say, anyone who's... I mean, there's never a great time to lose your mum anyway. But I think for me, at that age of 12, it was tough. And that's why I think, in a weird way, not that I'd ever wished to lose my mum again at that age, but I think if I didn't lose my mum at 12, I don't think I would have recovered as well as I have done from being blown up in Afghanistan, because I think that taught me so much about resilience and determination and just showed me how, you know, tough life can be. So I think it definitely helped me in later years for the other challenges that I was to face. That being said, though, I wouldn't like to go through it again because it was definitely the worst thing ever, losing my mum at that age.
Yeah, your daughter's coming up to that age. How old is Alba now?
So she's going to be 10 in October.
Okay, yeah. So
it's really weird that you say that because I turned 36 in June and I'm not one of these people that kind of think of ages and dates and birthdays, but I mean, I just still probably got the mindset of an 18-year-old still, and the fact that I'm going to be 36, which is where my mum died. And I guess at 12, I looked at her and thought, you know, she's really old. And it's only when you get to that age and you think, you know, I'm not old at all. I still feel like a baby in many ways. So, yeah, I've got kind of a weird, you know, a weird feeling about turning 36 just because of obviously what happened to my mum. And obviously having Alba, a similar age as well to what I would have been. It's weird.
Yeah. Well, and again, your mum is listed throughout the book in those key moments when you had to really dig deep. You know, that wanting to make her proud. Obviously, your dad as well. But, you know, I think I remember reading a moment where you were like just looking up, and I think it was when you were training for the Green Beret, and you were just had to, you looked up and you just went, you know, come on, you know, you just thought about your mum, and it just got you over, didn't it? It got you that extra push.
Yeah, it was weird. I think, again, I say, you know, all the time, my mum showed me enough love in those 12 years to last a lifetime. And I'm not even a religious person, but I did find myself all throughout my teens and early 20s, you know, always saying a little prayer every night towards my mum. Again, I don't know what I really believe in when it comes to religion or what happens when you're dead, but I'm definitely more spiritual and more kind of always had this feeling of, you know, she's kind of looking over me. So whether it was, I don't know, was it as a teenager, or whether it was in the Marines, you know, asking for a bit of good luck, or whether it was when I ended up going out to Iraq and Afghanistan, it was always like a kind of little prayer and a little, come on, mum, please, help me get through this. And I think that's something that stayed with me. And like I say, yeah, she had just a huge impact on my life, and losing her was really tough. But as I'm older now, when I kind of look back and try and look at the positives, like I just mentioned, then the positives are it definitely made me more of a resilient person, and it made me realise just, you know, what I can overcome and what I can achieve in life.
Yeah, 100%. I talk to my mum all the time. I've had, you know, during my counselling, they say, they use the phrase, you can talk them alive, it's okay. So I used to go, God, am I cracking up, you know, sometimes, yeah. You know.
All the time, and yourself.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, what a legacy even to just have that, wouldn't you know, if we just know that we leave this planet or wherever we go, knowing that there's somebody still here who's willing us still to be here, and we're still having an impact, so...
You know, yeah, one of my favourite things is I kind of feel it a little bit with the motivational speaking that I do now. It's a saying, and it kind of goes like, you know, people won't always remember what you say, and people won't always remember what you do, but people will remember how you make them feel. And I think, obviously, my mum, I can't remember every conversation or, you know, things she'd said and done in the exact word for word, but, you know, I remember how she made me feel, and I think that's the legacy that you talk about that lives on. And I think that's, if we can all kind of live by that, I think the world would be a better place.
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, you find yourself at 12, obviously you've lost your lovely mum, but your family rally, and, you know, I know you're all really close. You go through, and school was okay as well, I think, you know, I think you did, you know, you were happy, you know, to however you can be happy having lost your mum, you know, people rallied and people were supportive. But, you know, I know, and a lot of kids face this, they get to sort of 16, 17, and they're thinking, what the hell's next in my life? And the school system tends to push you down a particular route for A-levels or, you know, further education and whatever. And you did start on that, didn't you? But you realised very quickly it wasn't for you, especially on the day that you saw an advert and you had a quick chat to your dad.
I mean, I loved school. I loved, you know, my childhood. Apart from, like you say, losing my mum, I had, you know, great childhood. I'm from Bootle, and never kind of wanted for much, you know, never had a lot, but I never wanted for nothing, if that makes sense. Great childhood, great friends, great school. And I just think it's a massive pressure for 16, 17-year-olds to almost decide what they want to do with the rest of their life. You know, again, being from Bootle, again, I think it's, if you look at the kind of the media or the news, it's one of the most deprived areas in the UK. Now, I never ever felt that. It's only when you move away and you realise some of the opportunities that you maybe don't get. So there was certain maybe jobs and life prospects, if you like, that I could have maybe thought of, but I didn't even know they existed, if you like, do you know what I mean? I didn't, you know, no one from Bootle was going skiing that I ever knew, so you're kind of almost limited in your beliefs, really. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and it was a little bit like, well, my dad was kind of, look, I'm not having you sitting around all day, so you're going to do your A-levels. I was bright enough to do them. So I ended up doing English and History at A-level, and for me, it was a massive jump from GCSE to A-level.
It is, yeah.
And I just found, if I'm being honest, most of my time just sitting in the common room trying to chat up girls, to be honest. And I was skipping class and I just wasn't putting me all into it. That mixed with the fact that my dad was a firefighter, and, you know, he'd had a few cool stories, and he wasn't kind of doing a mundane office job. It was a pretty exciting job. And me being quite athletic, I was always fit and active. Thought of myself as one of the lads, if you like. And then I saw an advert for the Royal Marines, and it said 99.99% need not apply. Being the kind of cocky 17-year-old that I was, I thought, you know what, I'd like to give that a go. And that very quickly transpired into me going on to Meet the Marines Day. And what kind of sold the Marines for me is I went down and met at the Liver Buildings, and there was a couple of Marines there who turned up in a minibus. And there was a load of kind of hopefuls that just wanted a little to peer into what their life was like as a Marine. I'm a, you know, either 16 or 17. I think I might have just been 17. And you see these two young strapping lads in their early 20s, you know, big, muscly lads, good looking lads. They'd been on a night out in Liverpool the night before. They're talking and they're speaking in a different language. They're talking about a run ashore, which means a night out. Yeah. Talking about we're getting the wets in, which means getting the beers in. Talking about trapping chicks, which means basically pulling a girl, you know, in a nightclub. You've got this language, and I'm just looking at these two lads, and they're having, you know, big smiles on the face. You know, they're working on a Saturday, and, you know, you ask most people, they don't want to work on a Saturday, but these two lads are, you know, buzzing, and I'm thinking, God, they've just got such a spring in their step, and they, you know, I'm asking them questions, and the Marines never, ever looked to me like it was going to be a job. It just looked like, you know, being away with the lads almost, you know what I mean? And yeah. Maybe that was a bit naive, but as a kind of young 17-year-old, it wasn't so much the job title of a Marine. I just thought, I want to be like these lads. I want to be friends with these people. And I think that, for me, was what sold it for the Marines, just to be part of this brotherhood.
Yeah. And, you know, again, the saying is, you're the sum of the people you surround yourself with. And, you know, what a start and an inspiration for a young 17-year-old lad who was sort of lost his way. And straight away you were hooked, weren't you? But like you say, I love the fact that it wasn't about the whole firing guns and war and stuff. It was just about that feeling of belonging to an elite group of, well, even just a group of people who are good people. And then you've got the elite on top, which was to come, because you had to earn that, didn't you?
I think that's maybe where... I mean, I've never actually went and, you know, seen a psychologist or anything, but maybe that's to do with maybe losing my mum. I wanted a kind of feeling of belonging again or something. And like you say, the fact that it was the kind of elite, it wasn't just some kind of ragtag army. You're talking about like the Marines, respected all over the world. So that was the extra buzz that I needed. And like you say, best decision I ever could have made, really, to join.
And again, I'm going to keep saying you're age 17, is that right? So the application process starts. And the first phase is to get the boots, is that right? You've got to get the boots to then do the training, earn the boots to then the boots.
You kind of do your written test and then you do your, obviously, physical test. But then the big thing was, but I'm not sure they still do it maybe, or whether it's the same, done in the same way, but they used to do something called the PRMC, which was the pre-Royal Marine course. And you'd basically go down to Limston and spend 3 days with them. And it was a case for them to look at you, but also you to look at them. And it was done on the same camp where you'd be going through your training, and you'd spend 3 days, if you like, I suppose, just getting beasted, you know, getting put through your paces and kind of to see if you've got what it takes. And again, it was a chance for you to look at what life would be like. And then if you passed that course, you got given a pair of boots. And then the idea was you'd wear in those boots over the next kind of couple of months until you got your start date. So that was a big thing for me to kind of, you know, hopefully come home with a set of boots. And I remember coming off the train at Lime Street and going straight to my dad's fire station in Kirkdale, wearing the boots. And that was a big thing for me to say, look, I've at least been accepted onto to at least start the Marines, which was a massive thing for me. And it was, and then that's where the hard work really started. Then it was a case of wearing the boots, going on, you know, your long runs in the boots. And the idea being, when you do start training, they're not going to be rubbing, etc. And, you know, they're going to fit nicely. But yeah, that was like really the big, big first step into becoming a Marine.
Yeah, and then just give me a quick feeling of the training for this young kid that you had to go through. Give me a quick example of what you've had to do to get that Green Beret.
I mean, when I try and talk about the Marine training, I think, listen, it goes without saying, it's physically very tough, it's physically very demanding, it's physically very challenging, but it's all very progressive. You know, you don't turn up week one, day one, and they ask you to run 30 miles. You know, that comes at the end of training. So don't get me wrong, I could talk all day about the physical challenges. It was tough, but for me, it was just more about mental stuff. And, you know, the first part of training is like a game. You know, they just want you to give up, and it's just kind of making you want to quit, really. So a stupid example I'll kind of tell you is, they'd have us all lined up outside the accommodation block. There'd be 60 of us all going through training, and you'd always have to carry around a 2-litre bottle of water. And then they'd say, right, lads, we need you out here in 2 minutes. Now, to get 60 people in three lines in 2 minutes, it's quite difficult if you're rushing everyone. So for whatever reason, we wouldn't be. So they said, get this bottle of water, pour it over your head. So you obviously then soaked wet through, and they say, right, you've got 2 minutes to go and change, get back out here, go. So straight away, you all run in. Again, it's impossible for 60 lads to run in an accommodation block on the second floor, get undressed, get dressed again, and be back out in 2 minutes. So when they wouldn't do that, they'd speak to you very softly, very calmly, and say, lads, it's a simple task. All we asked you to do is do this. Go in, get changed into shorts and T-shirt. You've got 2 minutes. We'd all go in, do that again. Obviously, we wouldn't do it. So we'd all be doing press-ups in between this, and it was just a case of doing that on repeat. And then after about an hour of running in and out, getting changed, there were some guys who turned around and say, you know, well, this is bullshit. I'm not doing this no more. This is just, this isn't what the Marines is. This is just complete, you know, it's stupid what they're doing. And that would make people quit. And although that's got nothing to do with being a soldier, it has got a little bit to do with your mindset and, you know, your determination and your resilience. So that was just a little example of it. It's not all kind of, you know, press-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, big long runs. A lot of it was different kind of stuff just to test you mentally. You know, when you're cold, wet, tired and hungry, and you still got that same kind of that feeling to want to be a Marine. So, yeah, it was fun. I loved it. And I think because I was 17, I was kind of quite used to taking orders in, you know, albeit in school. And you didn't get paid much money, but I think the £600-£700 a month I was getting paid, I thought I was a millionaire every weekend anyway. So it was, I loved it, yeah. It was tough, but I absolutely loved it.
And was it during this training that I think his name was Ben, and he was a Scouser. Did he was one of your trainers, but he went off to war, and that was the reality of it. And he lost his life. Is that right?
You know what? Like we've just kind of joked about before. Maybe it was naive, maybe it was stupid, but for a long time I was just so excited to be part of this kind of big boys club, and I turned up and my physical training instructor, my PTI, was a guy called Ben Novak, who was some speak, big character in the Marines, held a few of the records in the Marines for what, some of the physical records, really, you know, legendary status, if you like. And he was my training instructor for the first, I think, 16 weeks. And then he got posted up to 4-5 commando and went to serve out in Iraq. Obviously, my training continued within the Marines. I think it was around week 22, 23. We got news that Ben had been killed in an explosion in Iraq. And for me, that was the kind of first moment I thought, you know, I actually know someone now in the Marines who was being killed. And it was a little bit like a case of, you know, this isn't just about being part of a big boys club anymore. You know, there's serious, you know, repercussions, really, what happened when you get out of training and you have to go to war. And I was just gutted, really. I can't say I knew Ben on a friendly level because I was still going through training and he was a corporal. But there was almost that feeling of once I'd passed out of training, I'd potentially serve alongside him. I'd potentially then be his friend. We'd then potentially go out on the beers together. So I think to not get to know Ben, you know, that was and he was a big inspiration to me going through training. So that absolutely killed me. And I thankfully now since, obviously, because I mentioned him in the book, I've since met his family.
Nice.
And you know, I've spoke to them, you know, quite a bit, and friends of his, so I feel like I got to know him a little bit more, albeit after he's passed away. So yeah, it was a real kind of sobering moment for me, really, going through training.
Yeah, but again, fair play to you to carry on. You could have gone one way or the other with that, couldn't you, Andy? You could have took it as, oh, it's someone like Ben and he's being killed, somebody who held in such high esteem.
Yeah.
Or actually what it sounds like has happened has gone, it's actually made you more determined to do him proud maybe as well deep down.
Yeah, it was definitely maybe the idea of doing him proud. And I think because, you know, you're looking at people like Ben, and I'm constantly kind of ringing home, telling my dad stories of all these legends that I'm meeting, and you know, ringing my dad saying, got my physical and training instructor, my PTI is a Scouser, and he happens to be this legend. You know, you kind of then want to follow in their footsteps. So there was no chance of me ever kind of throwing the towel in, because I think my dad had told half a boot that I was already in the Marines at this point, so there was no chance of me kind of coming home before I'd done it. So
I can totally see that, something my mum would have done as well, but yeah. So fast forward then, can I skip over the Green Beret bit? I mean, what was that like actually getting it? I was just, I mean, obviously there's so much we could talk about, but
Just quickly.
That moment when, you know, you actually, there was actually a hard call, something at the end, so that then you got awarded it, wasn't there? I think that's when you then you looked up and asked your mum for help to get you over the line, I think.
Yeah, it was during the 30 miler. So the final test you have to do is you have to run 30 miles carrying about 50 or 60 pounds worth of kit, and by far the toughest test I'd done to date. And again, that's probably when I'd, you know, done a little prayer to my mum saying, help get me over the line, and which I did. And then you're awarded the Green Beret and the right to call yourself a Royal Marines Commando. And it's just, you know, a bit kind of lump in your throat moment just to think, you know, God, I've finally done it. I'm 18 now at the point, and I'm thinking, wow, it was all worth it. You know, I'm part of this big boys club that I wanted to be part of, and just a real special moment. But then, you know, in a funny way, you kind of, 2 weeks later, you go and join your unit, and then you're bottom of the pile again. So that feeling doesn't kind of last long, really.
Yeah. So you very quickly end up in Iraq, is that right? And I know, we will get on to Afghanistan quite quickly. But obviously, Iraq, I think, was a little bit of a test bed. You said it was more like, it was much more fun about camaraderie, which is what you were looking for. So I think in a way that probably worked out. You dipped your very little toe into what it was like being part of this elite group in Iraq before the reality of Afghanistan hit.
Yeah, in many ways, it was the perfect tour for a kind of young Marine. I was based in Umkazar on the Kuwaiti border, and it was basically just a force protection team that was there to kind of help mentor and train the Iraqi Marines and the Iraqi Navy in the hope that when we left, it would be in a better place. And to be honest, yeah, I was never in any real danger. I never had to fire my weapon once in anger. I got to learn a bit of the language, a bit of the culture. And it was just a kind of a small base we shared with the Americans, and really, really chilled out. We had, you know, a nice gym. You could go on long runs into the desert, nice food, nice bathrooms, and, you know, a lot of banter with the lads, you know, in the gym all the time, a lot of sunbathing, a lot of volleyball, a bit like Top Gun, if you like. It was pretty chilled out time. And in many ways, it was a lot of fun there as well. So again, yeah, it was probably the perfect warm up to what Afghanistan would be.
Yeah. And then you get told you're going to Afghanistan, but actually, again, the training for that brings home some reality, doesn't it? I think, in terms of what to expect. You have a moment where you just thought, I want to go home? Did you ever have that wobble when they were actually preparing you that you were going in up against the Taliban?
Yeah, I remember coming home one weekend from Scotland, and that previous week we just had lecture upon lecture of other Marines coming in, talking about their experiences, just talking about, you know, Afghanistan as a country, you know, what it was like to patrol there. I'm talking about the enemy, who was, you know, in many ways formidable in, you know, in certain parts. And at this just one particular week, as the training's going on, I just felt like every single day I was being told how the Taliban were going to kill me, whether that was by a roadside bomb, from a suicide bomb, from snipers, from, you know, just over and over again being told all the dangers. And I remember coming home one weekend and had a little bit of a breakdown really with my dad, and just being like, I'm actually a bit nervous here, Dad. You know, this is going to be really, really dangerous. And, you know, it's very difficult to compare wars and conflicts and operations, but Afghanistan was seeming to be like one of the worst kind of war zones we've been in, you know, for a long, 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 long time. And it just, I think it maybe became a little bit just too much for me. I just think it was the relentless kind of lectures and trying, as they were trying to prepare us, just kind of got on top of me and had a little bit of a kind of mini breakdown to my dad. And probably should ask my dad how he felt about that, because I don't know what else he could have said to me, you know, apart from, look, it'll be okay, you know, you'll be fine. And yeah, it was, I think that at that point I started to realise, look, this is going to be a tour like I've never done before, really.
And again, perspective, Andy, you were, what, 19?
Yeah.
19, 20, it will, either way. Yeah. So young.
That's the only time I never ever feel sorry for myself, and I don't think I've ever held a kind of victim mentality. But it's only, funnily enough, when I look back at pictures at just before I was due to deploy to Afghanistan, I do feel a little bit sorry. It's weird, I don't feel sorry for myself, but I almost look at this kind of young lad in a picture and think like you were just a baby, you know what I mean? It doesn't feel like me, it doesn't feel like it was me. I feel sorry on this young kid who doesn't know what he's about to kind of go through, if that makes sense.
Absolutely makes sense, 100%. I mean, I went round America on a bus with my backpack at 19. I made up with that. I say I didn't have a phone. Yeah. and I did it. And I didn't know where I was going, and I was meeting people and sleeping on floors. And that's my little heroic moment. I think it sort of slightly pales into insignificance with what you were about to face.
No, and that's what I think maybe in later life, I've kind of thought, God, I wish, because I don't regret anything about joining the Marines, but I kind of wish that I'd maybe done the kind of uni lifestyle and maybe took a gap year and kind of, yeah, you know, done the shell really and just done and all that really. And then went to Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, you just go and like represent the country and against the horrors of the Taliban at 19. Unbelievable. So, you know, we were building up to, you know, the big moment, and the moment that you say, I know you say it doesn't define you, but it is an incredible story of camaraderie, heroism. And again, the book, I'm going to bring back people back to the book, because it's graphic, but it's actually very readable. It's not, you know, what happened to you, it's brilliantly written, that particular, I mean, all of the book is brilliantly written, but that particular part, it's the core really for me of the book. And, you know, Phil's done an absolutely brilliant job, but when you must have opened up to him about that, where did you even begin? Could you just remember it so graphically?
I mean, what's funny is obviously I do this motivational speaking now, and I probably do myself out of a job here saying this with the speaking, but I tell the story so many times when I'm doing the motivational speaking, it almost doesn't feel like, it's like I'm reading a script almost about yeah. that many times, I can just tell it. Whereas when I spoke down with, when I sat down with Phil, I think the fact he's one of my best mates anyway, and he was kind of really like, what happened? And then it was like, what did it smell like? You know, what can you see? What did you feel? And we're sitting there over a beer, and I was really able to open up. And when someone asked me, maybe a random person asked me, maybe I'll just say, oh, this is what happened. But then when you're sitting there with your mate and there's a dictaphone in front of us and he just kind of says, you know, what was it like? I just found kind of all memories that maybe were there and I never really tapped into coming out, and I was able to explain it to him in such a way. And like you say, he's done a fantastic job of you know, really telling that story and bringing it to light. And again, it was really therapeutic to sit there, and actually it was nice in a weird way to just look back at that day and think about it in a different way, and maybe detail things that I'd never really kind of thought about as much. And yeah, like I say, he's really brought that kind of morning to light.
Yeah. Do you think going through that process, we'll come on to actually what happened, but do you think going through that process has massively helped? I mean, you said you haven't had therapy, but ultimately you've dug deep and you've opened up. I mean, not just about that, but, you know, about the whole of your life, but about that particular moment. Do you think it's helped you?
100%. I've never ever thought that, you know, I've never been someone to hold stuff in. I've always been pretty open, like say with my dad and my sisters, and quite a close family, and I'm not afraid to say if I need help or I'm struggling with something. So I've always been quite okay in that sense. But I think for me, writing the book, it felt for me like I'd kind of got the monkey off my back. I'd kind of, you know, maybe had a few skeletons in the closet that I was a bit maybe ashamed of or nervous of. And I just felt by sitting down and being vulnerable and opening up, I think that helped a lot. Talking about things that I've maybe not spoken to anyone about before, which I'm sure we come on to, but I was told I wouldn't be able to have kids after the blast. And I think something like that was something I'd never spoken about. And the fact I was able to sit down with Phil and go into detail about some of those, you know, really sensitive issues was massive for me. And I think that's, you know, a lot of times in life, you know, when we talk about trauma, it's when you kind of, something's happened and you've buried, put it in a box and buried it deep and hid it away. Whereas I think this, writing this book, and the fact, again, it was with my best mate, the fact I was able to be so open and honest and just get it all out there, I think in the long run, yeah, it massively helped with my mental health and being able to cope with everything.
Yeah, what an endorsement, Andy, for the power of conversation right there. So honestly, thank you for that. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you have to find the right person to talk to, but the key is to talk, isn't it?
Yeah.
And have somebody who's just sitting there actively listening. And but he had a job to do. He was honing in on that detail and he got it out of you. So, you know what? Yeah. Congratulations to Phil. And, you know,
and it was his first book as well. So I think it just shows how talented he was. And his dad is Brian Reid, who's wrote a few books as well. And think the book got nominated for Sports Book of the Year, which I don't think his dad's ever done. So I think he's going up on his dad now as well.
I love that. Absolutely brilliant. So, okay, let's take us to, tell us the story. Tell us that what happened on that fateful night. The bit of the build-up as well, obviously, because I think you knew that this particular time. I think you'd been there about six months, had you? Is it like, I don't know.
4.5 months I'd been there, yeah. And this was one of the last big pushes, really, because, I mean, it sounds bizarre, but there was almost a pact with the Taliban that there was going to be a ceasefire in, like, the next week or two. Which is bizarre. It was almost like the Taliban wanted to farm all the heroin and sell it. So for that to happen, they didn't want to have a fight. So they basically just said, you know, in 2 weeks we're going to stop fighting. So we were like, okay. So in those kind of 2 weeks, it was a case of pushing the Taliban back as far as we could. So this is one of the last big really patrols of the 6 month tour. Like I said, we had about 6 weeks left before we were due home, and the night before we had a briefing and we got split up into two sections. And half the guys were going to go to the east and half the guys were going to the west. And the guys who had to go to the east had to get up. Guys who had to go to the west had to get up about 2 o'clock in the morning and had to walk a little bit further. The guys to the east didn't have to wake up as early as we weren't going as far. So straight away, it was a bit like happy days. We get an extra hour or two in our bed. So we kind of knew it was going to be a big patrol and we knew the objective. We knew the mission and that was it. Prepped all our kit and, you know, set our alarms for 4 o'clock in the morning. Got up, had a bowl of porridge. And as we were eating our bowl of porridge, I was sitting next to Ian. And me, Ian and Ryan were all best friends. And Ryan, over a bowl of porridge, announced over the porridge that he'd had a dream that Ian had got blown up.
Oh,
to which Ian replied, you know, nice one for that, mate. I'm about to go and lead the patrol out, and I'm point man. I'm the first man. So Ian wasn't too happy about this, you know, claim from Ryan. But, you know, how often do you have a dream and it comes true? You know what I mean? Very rarely. So that gets said. We finish our breakfast and we all get out and get our kit on and get ready for this patrol. It's 5 o'clock in the morning now, half five. It's pitch black. You can barely see a hand in front of your face, and the patrol sets off. I think we've been on patrol maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. And it was a case of just going over farmland, really, just jumping over a series of irrigation ditches and zigzagging almost through fields. And then as we're going, like I say, about 20 minutes in, Ian said, we need to get over this ditch at some point. So I think whenever you're ready, I'm, you know, good to go, I'm right behind you. So he's kind of walking along this field, and to our right-hand side, there's this ditch, and he's just kind of monitoring the ditch, waiting to see where a good place to jump is. A couple more minutes later, he says, Andy, we're going to go here. I said, yeah, whenever you're ready, mate, I'm good to go. And I just remember, and again, I remember it like it was yesterday. And actually, it's the 3rd of February is the date. So it's 15 years tomorrow, which is absolutely mental to think that as I'm sitting here now telling this story to you, 15 years ago, it was the day before it happened. You know, I'm getting that brief, you know, 15 years ago today, which is mental. And as Ian's walking along, he says, yeah. And I can see his face coming towards me saying, right, I'm going to jump here. And he steadies himself, runs and jumps. And I'm almost, you know, ready for him to jump over the ditch to go next. And as he's kind of jumped over the ditch, I just remember hearing two of the loudest bangs I've ever heard before. And everything just went pitch black. And I straight away knew in that moment, I just straight away thought, shit. I just knew straight away I'd been blown up. I remember falling back and then straight away just started screaming as loud as I could, because I didn't know whether I'd fell into the ditch. I didn't know whether I'd been blown 50 meters away. Like I say, it was pitch black. I didn't know whether the guard would be able to see me. So my initial thought was, you know, make as much noise and hopefully the guys can get to me as quickly as they can. It turns out that I'd only fell back kind of a meter or two and was almost kind of lying on the edge of the ditch. Straight away, that's when the teamwork kicked in. The guys got to me as quickly as they could and started, you know, patching me up and doing everything they could to keep me alive. They placed a tourniquet on my groin, a guy called James Smith, which, you know, I owe my life to. He placed a tourniquet on my groin as I'd severed my femoral artery. You see, you can bleed to death within 6 minutes if anything happens to this. And straight away, they seen that tourniquet on and then spent the next 40 minutes really patching me up and doing everything they could to keep me alive. Until then, a helicopter comes in and picks me up.
Oh
It was strange, really, because as the bombs went off, Ian's been blown forward and took a nasty bang to the head and doesn't remember anything about this morning. All he can remember is going to bed the night before. Yeah, I get blown up and I remember the whole 40 minutes or so until I get placed on the helicopter. And then that's when my memory goes a little bit. Don't really remember much from then. And then I wake up 2 weeks later then.
But again, what an incredible story. It's like something from a movie scene, truly. But again, coming full circle back to your need and want for camaraderie and support and teamwork and brotherhood. And, you know, there's probably been fellas in there that you didn't probably love that much, or, you know, as life is. But in that moment, that training and everything, even that running in and out, pouring water over your head, come back in 2 minutes, it sorted the wheat from the chaff in terms of what had to happen in that moment and how they gathered around you and kept you alive.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some lads there that's a pet hate really I have with the military. Everyone thinks it's this brotherhood and everyone loves each other. And in the whole, you know, you mostly do get on, but of course there are going to be people who you don't get on with and stuff, and there's maybe people who you don't know as well as, you know, other people. And when I got blown up, you know, some of the guys who were there first to rescue me, I didn't particularly know that well. You know, which goes to show what we said before, you know, that kind of training, how important it is to get everyone really bought into the idea. And when those guys got to me and just doing everything they could, then that, you know, the camaraderie, you know, we call it commando humor, that dark humor, you know, continued. Then I'm lying there with, you know, I had 27 separate injuries. I had shrapnel to my face, broken sternum, broken elbow, got chunks missing out both forearms. Now you can kind of see the scars and arms and stuff. You know, all these 27 different injuries, I'm got on a stretcher and we're just waiting for the helicopter to come in. And, you know, lads are saying, well, you know, you won't be winning the football tournament now, will you? Because we had a little football tournament on base. You know, when everyone's joking, saying, you haven't even done a full tour, you know, you're going home after half a tour. And so all that banter is still going on, despite the fact I'm bleeding to death.
And not only that, they probably had to. Do they have to protect you from a follow-up attack, I suppose, I'm thinking?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, you know, the leaders of the group, you know, the sergeant majors and the sergeants, the sergeant majors, the majors of that particular patrol. The things that are going on, they're spinning so many plates, you know, straight away they're getting guys, the medics to me to make sure that, you know, they keep me alive. They're forming all around protection to make sure there's not a follow-up attack from the enemy. Yeah. They're calling in a helicopter, you know, they're giving the grid reference of where we are. There's so much to go on, you know, that they're, I think the leaders in our military are just some of the best people in the world for, you know, the pressure that they're under, the things that they're seeing. Again, spinning all those plates, just unbelievable job that they've done. And on this morning, you know, the fact that they got both of us out of there, you know, fended off any other attacks, managed to get the helicopter in, and we both survived. It's just an unbelievable day at the office.
Unbelievable. And when you talk about your gallows humour about trying to keep you alive, but again, power of conversation point, if ever there was one, you know, they were talking to you to keep you present.
Yeah, it was a case of, and I even remember those conversations. It was quite weird, actually. It was, and just shows you how the body works. I remember lying there pretty much, I was freezing, and I said, lads, I'm really cold. And they said, Andy, you're lying there naked, mate, because they basically cut all my clothes off me to, you know, patch me up. So I couldn't really see anything because of all the dirt and debris in my eyes. But the lads are talking to me, and it obviously gets to like 30, 35 minutes in. Mm-hmm. And I've obviously lost a lot of blood. And if I'm being honest, I'm probably a few minutes away from dying.
Yeah.
And it was a case of just waiting for the helicopter to come in. You know, they'd done everything they could. It was just, we need the helicopter to come in. And I'm starting to feel tired and sleepy. And the guys are saying, Andy, keep on talking. I'm like, what do you want to talk about? And they're like, anything, come on, just keep on talking. And I'm like, go on then, talk to me. And I can just feel myself, just, you know, you just can't really be bothered. And you're like, okay, go on, what? And they're like, Andy, come on. And then that's when they started, come on, you scouser, you gobshite, you know, you're this and that. You know, just trying to, anything to just kind of get me going. And I guess, yeah, I was probably just a couple of minutes away from dying. And that's when the helicopter came in.
Yeah, and then obviously you did survive, and thank God for that. But then you've got that whole next follow 18 months or so of recovery, and but not only physical recovery, you know, the mental realization of your career potentially coming to an end. I guess you were told that at some point, I'm not sure when. You know, you couldn't have children was in the mix as well, which I know you only spoke about much later on in life. And you know, your leg and your physical ability and how that would potentially limit you in life. Obviously it hasn't, now we can look back, but you can't, as they say, you can't join the dots going forward. You did not know. There must have been some very dark moments.
Yeah, incredibly. I mean, there was essentially three big realizations I had to come to terms with. That was, number one, I knew I thought at that point that, you know, my kind of life as I knew it, this kind of adventurer, this traveler, this, you know, young, fit marine, that was gone. You know, I looked at my leg, the injuries I sustained, I thought it's going to be impossible for me to ever run again, to run a marathon, to climb mountains. I thought that was gone. So that was the first realization. Second realization was, you know, I'm a realist and I just knew I wouldn't be able to sustain a career in the Marines. No one needed to tell me that you can't be a Marine anymore. I just knew, you know, like we spoke about before, what was needed to get into the Marines, how physically fit you needed to be. I thought, that's it, I'm going to have to leave. And that absolutely killed me. And the third realization was getting told that I'd actually lost both testicles in the blast and I wouldn't be able to have children. Mm. And we spoke already about my mum and what family means to me. And, you know, I always wanted to, you know, meet a girl, get married, buy a big house and have loads of kids. And kind of getting told that you can't have them. And I know some people choose not to have kids and that's fine, but I love kids, you know, I wanted to have kids. And being told at 20 you can't have them was just so heartbreaking. Added to the fact that, you know, a couple of weeks earlier, I was 20 years of age, doing the job I loved, with the rest of my life ahead of me. The next minute, my dad is spoon-feeding me. I'm getting told, you know, you'll probably never run again. You've lost your career. You can't be a dad. It was a lot for a 20-year-old to take in.
I can't even imagine. And then your dad, bless him, you know, what he had to carry to, you know, his son lost you lost your mom and obviously the, you know, your family and what they had to see. And but how proud he must be of you, Andy. Oh my God.
Seriously. Yeah, listen, I went for breakfast with him this morning. You know, we're still best mates now. We see each other every day, and you know, he is incredibly proud. And I think what hurts him most is the fact that the things that have happened to me, they're not kind of really solvable things. It's like, you know, if I said to him, you know, Dad, I've got a, you know, something's broken my house, he's a handyman, he can come around, he can fix it. But, you know, when his son's, you know, lost his mum, he can't do anything. When his son's lost the ability to have children, he can't really do anything. It's like,
yeah,
just kind of sit there. He wants to fix it and he can't. It's just a case of being there. And thankfully he has been there. And like you say, we're still best mates now. But that's, I think, the thing that's been tough, the fact that the things that have happened, they're not really fixable.
Yeah, but what was fixable, ironically, was actually for you to get your life back on track. You had to make the biggest decision of your life, and you had 18 months of, I guess, was it about 18 months of giving it a go, of living with your injuries the way they were, but then you were exposed to people who made that decision as well, or had just lost their legs in combat. And you saw that there was light at the end of the tunnel, but you had to make a big decision.
Yeah, it was a massive decision because, I mean, who when would you ever decide to chop off a part of your body? Do you know what I mean? It doesn't really happen. And That's the kind of decision I had. You know, that the surgeon was telling me that I could keep the leg and was kind of giving me my chances of recovery and what my life would be like, or I could have the leg amputated. And initially I was in no rush to start chopping parts of my body off that might not need to be chopped off. So I thought, you know, let's give the cage that was on my leg a go, and let's try and rehab this leg as best as possible. But then as I went down to Headley Court, which was the rehabilitation centre, I was quickly seeing other amputees, other people with far worse injuries than me, having a better quality of life than me. And that's when I started thinking of the kind of what if my life was that of an amputee, you know, what would it be like? And I think the straw that kind of broke the camel's back was I went on an adventure training holiday with the Marines to Bavaria, Germany, and it was all for injured soldiers. So the adventure training was kind of at different levels, if you like. And a good friend of mine who had served in Afghanistan had also been blown up and lost an arm and a leg. And his leg was from above the knee. And if I was to have my leg amputated, it would only be below the knee. So there's a massive difference. And I'm walking around with my leg, with my limp. And he's walking around with one arm and one leg pretty well. And after one particular day, I think we were out bike riding or we'd been kayaking or something. I said to Johnny, I said, you know, if you could swap your prosthetic leg for my bad leg, you know, would you take it? And he said, not a chance. He said, your leg is fucked. He said, I'd rather have my prosthetic leg than yours. And that was a big kind of, you know, moment, if you like, a big, like you said at the start of the podcast, you know, these conversations that kind of shape your life.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at a guy who'd lost two limbs, far more injured than me, and he'd rather keep his prosthetic leg than swap it with my leg. And I thought, wow, maybe I need to look at this a little bit more. And then that's when the conversations of potentially amputating my leg became a lot more real. I started sitting down with my surgeon and discussing it. But it was still a massive decision, as you can imagine. And it's one that didn't come easy, because speaking to my dad didn't want me to have the leg amputated. Mm. It was really, again, I've, you know, got my daughter now. If she turned around to me and was going through something like that, I can totally get where he was coming from. He was of the mindset of just be grateful. Just be grateful you're alive. Who cares if you can't run? Just, you know, you don't want any more operations. You don't want any more time in hospital. Just be happy. Whereas I was like, look, Dad, I'm a young lad still, and there's a lot of life still in me. I want to be able to, you know, I don't want to live with this unfulfilled potential. So it was really tough to go against my dad, and, you know, and just to even live it myself, that, you know, you're chopping a part of your body off. It was just such an unnatural feeling. But that's the decision I decided to go with, and thankfully it was the right one.
Again, I'm coming back to your age, 22?
Yeah, it's probably 22 at this point now, yeah. Yeah, it was massive. I always say, you know, we said at the start, the kind of, you know, the formative years in your life, maybe say, you know, your teenage years to your early 20s. I think from 12 to 22, you know, at 12, I lost my mum. 17, during the Marines. 18, I was in Iraq. 19, I was in Afghanistan. 20, I got blown up. 21, I'm being told I can't have kids. 22, I'm then choosing to have my leg amputated. It was a mad 10 years when I look back, really.
That's an understatement, mate, to tell you. Oh, my God. But again, the key to that story is that you had to go with your own feeling in the end. You can talk to, I'm guessing you talk to surgeons and lots of other people. And, you know, you've got your dad there just instinctively wanting to protect you. Mm-hmm. But you had to do that for you. You had to dig deep and have a word with yourself, didn't you, to make that decision?
Yeah, and that's probably what was the hardest thing. Maybe sounds a bit not very courageous, really, but it's kind of like, because it's on you, you know, you can't really blame anyone else. If you make that decision, yeah, it's on you, isn't it? So there was no backup, really, to say, ah, well, you know, you told me to do this, or it was your idea. This was like, you've got to make a decision for you. And I think that's where the pressure came. And I think what ultimately, one of the main things as well, was one day I'd wake up and, you know, my leg would be okay. And I think, you know what? Life isn't so bad. I can keep this leg. It's fine. And then one day I'd wake up and I'd be bedbound. My leg would be in so much agony. And in the end, I got fed up of not knowing whether I was coming or going. Mm. But you know what? I just need to have the leg amputated, take back control of the situation, stop being a victim of this situation, and actually just get on with my life. And that's what I decided to do on the 25th of November, 2010.
And when you woke up, relief, scared?
I remember it, Michelle, like it was yesterday. There was two huge feelings. One was physical and one was mental. And I remember as soon as I opened my eyes, I picked up my leg. If you'd imagine you're lying down, and I picked my leg up, if you like, from the knee. And it moved really fast, because obviously there was no weight at the bottom of the leg. So I felt a physical weight loss of where my leg once was, which felt weird. But then straight away, I just felt like the weight of the world had just been lifted from my shoulders.
Really?
All this kind of 18 months of should I, shouldn't I, the conversations with my surgeons, with the psychologist, with my dad, with other amputees, all this, what shall I do? It all just went. I just felt like that pressure of the decision-making process had all just been lifted. And I just felt this like warm, fuzzy, excited feeling that, wow, this is okay. Let's crack on now.
Yeah, and you had a brilliant surgeon, didn't you? Again, he was part of the Marines, and obviously, I'm going to have to get you to tell the tattoo story, the good and bad news story.
Go on. So very good friend of my surgeon. I'd served in Iraq with him. He's in the Royal Navy, again part of the Marine setup, and he's one of the best surgeons in the country. And thankfully for me, a very good friend of mine. I'd asked him to amputate the leg, and when I wake up from the operation, he comes in, and I'm just obviously really eager to know that everything went okay. And he looks at me and he says, Andy, there's good news and there's bad news. Straight away, my heart stops thinking, you know, something's went wrong or there's been a complication. He says, well, the good news is everything went really well. I'm really happy with it. Thinking, you know, what could possibly be the bad news then? And so at which point he says and reminds me, I'm a Liverpool fan. Said, yeah, okay, what's that got to do with anything? He says, well, I noticed on your leg you had a tattoo of a live bird and you'll never walk alone. He says, now for me to create a decent stump for you so you can run and walk and climb mountains, I've had to pull the skin around from the back of the leg, and I'm really sorry, but I've cut off the word alone. I'll read you, you'll never walk. And I think for me, it's a great part of the story because, it became the title of the book. And, you know, when I do the motivational speaking, you know, it's a real roller coaster of emotions, like, you know, I'm guessing people will realise from the podcast, but it's a point in life, you know, to realise to never, ever take yourself too serious. You know, never, ever be afraid to laugh at yourself. And something that's thankfully provided a lot of laughs along the way.
Yeah. you actually genuinely couldn't write that. I mean, you know, it's just
crazy. Brilliant.
And the perfect title for the book, perfect title. I'm going to bring Patrick in because we have been gabbing for way longer. He's probably waving at me. Because we're going to come on to, you know, your life post that huge decision. You're a bit blurry, but anyway, we'll crack on. But Patrick, Andy's story to this point, I mean, you know, again, he's not out of the woods yet. He had still got a lot of mental adjustment to do, and there's lots more to talk about. But what are you thinking so far?
Well, firstly, Andy, what an absolute privilege to be backstage listening to your conversation with Michelle so far. And the thing that I find amazing about your story is that, you know, I've heard you speak before, and we've chatted, we've met briefly, and I've read your book. And it doesn't matter how many times I hear your story, it gives me goosebumps, and it's a source of inspiration. And that's incredible. You know, you'd think, well, okay, you've read it once and you know the story and that's it, but it truly is inspirational. And the other interesting thing, I think, is that, you know, in your book, you know, you write, I think I wrote it down, you don't ever want to be defined by a tripwire, by war, don't ever define you by being disabled. Don't take this the wrong way, but your story for me is as much what happened afterwards and the incredible achievements, physical athletic achievements and the things you've done since then, as much as, you know, those horrible moments in Afghanistan and you losing your leg. And that's the thing that's so impressive. For any average person, what you've achieved with one leg or two legs is absolutely incredible. So, just get that off. But I remember reading about, when you went, was it the Invictus Games that was your first big sort of almost public event where you could test yourself and challenge yourself, whether, you know, how fast you could be, how good you could be?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, just on your point though, I think what I've been really lucky with my story is, it's funny you say, obviously we've kind of had a beer together, you've read the book and you've heard me speak, but I've ended up doing talks sometimes in companies or schools, and people have heard me a couple of times. I think, God, why would you want to kind of hear the story a few times? And what I've took a lot of, you know, joy from, I'm really grateful for, is I think because the story is so varied, sometimes people pick up on different things. It might be, you know, my losing my mum element, and that kind of strikes a chord with people. Or it might be, you know, someone's had to make a big life change decision, and that kind of strikes a chord. So I've been really lucky in that sense. And yeah, you're totally right in the sense that me not wanting to be defined, I always kind of view my life now as, life is 10% the situation you find yourself in, 90% what you do about it. So for me, getting blown up in Afghanistan, you know, that's when I look back, I just want that to be a small 10% of my life. It's all the stuff which we're going to kind of talk about now, the Invictus Games, the world records, you know, my family. That's the 90% that I've kind of want to, you know, really make my own and own it. And the Invictus Games, I think, was probably the start of that, of getting out there. It was thanks to Prince Harry, that was his kind of idea. And that was the first time I'd almost I'd kind of had this attitude of wanting to redefine myself post-injury, but the Invictus Games was the first time I got to then compete against other injured soldiers. It got the kinds of competitive juices going again and just made me feel really, really part of it again. And again, yeah, probably one of the first kind of physical challenges that kind of set me on. This was in 2014 now, so you know, 3 or 4 years after the amputation. And it kind of got me going, thinking, you know what, I quite like this kind of life of action and adventure, and it would feed well in with my motivational speaking as well.
Hmm. And of course, you got, I'm right to say you got gold there, didn't you? You got the 400 metres and the 1500 metres gold. And yeah, in your book, you talk about... Oh, in the relay, yes. It was almost last minute. You were dragged in to compete in the relay. And you said that sort of cemented your way out of you, I think you said cemented your way out of the darkness is what I remember reading in your book.
Yeah, it helped massively because, like you say, and I always say this in the motivational talks, and that's why I'm probably so proud of the book, because I think the book does go into a lot of the kind of, like the kind of depression, or at least the down part of my life, because it hasn't always been, you know, climbing mountains and breaking records and running it, you know, far from it. There's been a lot of lows along the way. But I think the Invictus Games and the spotlight that was shone onto injured soldiers and the challenges of being physically fit and kind of just give me a bit of a purpose, and that kind of massively helped with my mental health, because there was definitely times where I was in a rut. You know, there was times in my life I was drinking too much, I was gambling too much, relationships were breaking down around me, and probably wasn't a nice person at times, and you know, my life was going nowhere fast at times. And I think the Invictus Games, kind of post 2014 and onwards, that was the kind of point where I kind of got my purpose back a little bit, and that come through physical challenges like the Invictus Games, like climbing various mountains and like setting myself personal targets. And I guess I owe a big thanks to Prince Harry and the Invictus Games for that.
Mm. And has that sort of competitive side of you, has that always been with you, or was that sort of reinvigorated and stimulated after you lost your leg and then you got your prosthesis? Because you seem to be always, well, from the book, you seem to be often surrounded by high performers. I mean, even Ben Novak, the way he was a high performer. I think he held the record for a while as to, you know, how quickly you could do the training course. You know, obviously your mates are Jamie Carragher, Ronnie O'Sullivan. These are all people who are top of their fields. Mm. Is that because you're so competitive and you want to, yeah, there was a phase of your life where you wanted to be as best as you could, be the best?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I don't know whether that, you know, you're kind of born with that as a kind of nature or nurture, I'm not sure. But I think even the fact, you know, when I wanted to join the Marines, I wanted to join the Marines because it was the 99.99% need not apply. So I think my mindset's always been, you know, to really strive for the top. And I think by having that attitude and acting in a certain way, just kind of by chance, it's sometimes put me in those circles with those elite people, which I'm very fortunate, you know, to call some of them friends. But I think, yeah, just maybe I was born with that kind of competitiveness, and I think the Marines have definitely bred that even more. And then, yeah, just having that attitude of, well, you know, if we're going to have a go with this, really, you know, really, really try. And it's that kind of funny saying, which isn't always true, but it's like anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Moderation's for cowards. That's not necessarily true in everything, but it's definitely true when it comes to, if you want to do something, you know, you've really got to go for it. And I think if I set my mind on something, I've really...
Well, you didn't want to write the book, did you, until you'd actually won, achieved something else? You didn't want the book to be about Andy who was blown up in Afghanistan and lost a leg. You wanted it to be about Andy the winner, Andy the achiever.
I just thought, you know, I mean, I know maybe for some people, telling a story getting blown up is quite interesting, and I do understand that. But for me, I know... got 60, 70 lads on my phone who are good friends who've all been blown up. To me, it's not a cool story, really, because it can be quite boring when I've heard that many of them. Whereas doing something on the back of it, that to me is, it's that whole saying again, it's not so much, you know, you aren't defined by life's problems and challenges, you're defined by how you react to them. You know, anyone can get blown up, do you know what I mean? It's about standing in the wrong place at the wrong time. Not everyone can go on and break a 10K record. Not everyone can do X, Y, and Z. So I think for me, it was all about, you know, getting those competitive juices flowing again and again, proving that I can be like that despite, you know, what happened. And that's why I waited out on the book until I felt like I'd done that.
Andy, the thing is, I think you're about 20 years younger than me. The sorts of feats that you've set yourself and you've achieved, are the sorts of things that me going through midlife now in my 50s, and whether you call it a midlife crisis or as we call it a midlife muddle, it's what people do. They decide to become triathletes and they decide to run marathons. But what you've done it really purposefully in your 30s. So the good thing is, I was going to say, well, what are you going to do next? And clearly you've set yourself, I mean, you're a very accomplished motivational speaker. But going on to that, I've listened to some of the things that are available, some of your talks that are available on YouTube. And I know you enjoy talking to young people in particular. What are the messages, and you give them lots to think about and to take away, but what are the messages that you think, particularly with young people, that they take away from having listened to you?
Yeah, I mean, just on that, I've been really lucky. It makes me feel really old now because I've been doing it maybe kind of 7-8 years. I'm at that point now where when I was speaking to 16-year-olds maybe 8 years ago, they're now at an age where they can have a beer. And it's happened a few times where I've been out in town and there's a group of lads who've come up to me and remembered me, which is really nice, but it does make me feel a little bit old now. And I think like we said at the start, Michelle, sometimes, you know, people won't always remember what you say or what you do, but people remember how you make them feel. And I'd like to think that I just give young people a feeling of hope that, you know, no matter how tough and challenging life can be, you know, anything is possible. I know it sounds a bit, you know, a bit cheesy, anything's possible, but again, just through some of the young people I'm lucky enough to know and be friends with now, it's kind of made them really think, you know, you do get one shot at life and, you know, you need to kind of grasp it and make the most of it because it's over so quick. You know, it's only when you look back now. I mean, on Saturday, I'm going to be enjoying, you know, celebrating 15 years post being blown up. It's gone and, you know, just like that. So I think the messages are to young people, which hopefully they get, is, you know, of hope that anything's possible. I say to young people, if you're not dreaming big enough, if your dreams don't scare you, you're not dreaming big enough. Because I think as well, like I look at my life growing up in Bootle, no one told me that you could go, you know, skiing or you could climb a mountain in Argentina or you could do this or do that. And I think, why not? You know, you can do that if you surround yourself with the right people. So I think a feeling of anything's possible, and that definitely fits in. And the last one probably is your surroundings as well. You know, I'm not the biggest fans of the, you know, Kim Kardashians of the world, if you like. I'm much more inspired by people that are actually doing stuff with their life. And I say to people, you know, if you hang around with 9 idiots, don't be so surprised when you become the 10th. And I think, you know,
I love that one.
I do love your social media rants, Andy, because it is a necessary evil in a way, but I'm always like, yes, oh my God, yes, influencers or whatever, and you know, and you say you just
sometimes, yeah.
did you read today? In fact, I read today that the TV program The Apprentice, Lord Sugar and the producers have basically said we're not allowing any influencers anywhere near that program. So they've worked out how to weed out social media influencers who all they're interested in doing is
raising their own profile.
Yeah, becoming famous, and they're weeding them out at the earliest possible stage of the application process for The Apprentice.
It's the opposite to Love Island.
Yeah.
I feel it.
What's your favourite programme, Andy?
I feel like, and I've wanted to kind of do this for ages, and I won't, because if I ever do say anything, it'll come across as quite bitter type thing. But I look at like my job, for example, and I've been very fortunate I've landed some really, really big motivational gigs over in China, America, all over Europe. I've done, whether it's, you know, Liverpool, Man City, England, when it comes to sport, I've done huge big banks, corporations. I've done, you know, hundreds and hundreds, spoke to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. So I feel very accomplished in the motivational speaking that I do. And I feel like I can provide, you know, real benefit. And what really annoys me about this kind of thing is, I think since COVID, I think everyone's became like this kind of motivational speaker and this health and well-being expert. And I feel like saying, like, God, what have I been doing all these years? Do you know what I mean? And it's so like, I mean, if I ever moaned about it, people would say I was jealous or I was bitter. But you look at these people who are hundreds of thousands of followers and they're like motivational. And I think, wow, okay, you know, I must have been doing something wrong for all these years. I don't know.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Because you need definitely way more buttons than them, and we're going to make that happen. Do you still want to do it? Does it still motivate you to motivate?
Yeah, you know what? I love it. And I think that's why kind of try and do different challenges and stuff, whether that's even just like a 5K. I'm going to attempt to try and do the Marathon des Sables. I'd love to one day row across the Atlantic Ocean. And I think me having the attitude of wanting to challenge myself and try new things feeds into the motivational speaking. And, you know, I've done, I think, 3 or 4 talks in January, a mixture of schools and corporate stuff. And I love it because, one, I'm traveling about, which I love to do. I'm meeting new people all the time. Some of these people then become friends, you know. And again, it sounds really cheesy, but I've had so many messages over the years of people listening to the talk and it really helping them in some way. And a couple of examples on that. I remember speaking to a lady once who was going through a really abusive marriage, and she kind of took in a weird way of me choosing to have my leg amputated and, you know, kind of cutting free from that. And kind of applied it to her life. You know, she'd been umming and ahhing, had to leave this marriage for a while, and she didn't know. And she kind of, not saying she left the marriage because of that, but it was definitely made it give her food for thought. And she sent me a lovely email, you know, months later, saying how it kind of helped in a small way. I've spoken to a guy once who had an infection in his eye, and it was causing him real pain, but no one knew he had this infection, and you couldn't really tell, but he couldn't see out of his eye, and it caused him a lot of pain. But he never wanted to do anything about it because he was scared how he'd look. And again, he listens to me having my leg amputated and thinks, God, what am I waiting for? And has the eye taken out, and it's the best thing he ever done. And he'd done it on the back of air of my talk. And, you know, you don't get these stories every time you do a talk. But over the years, you know, there's definitely been, you know, a dozen or so of them. And it makes you think, wow, you know, I am having an impact on people, whether that's, you know, 1 or 2 people a year or what. But it does give me a real buzz. And yeah, I still love doing it. I think I always will.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that's our thing with the podcast, is if we just help one person, if it's one little message from something either we say or a guest says just lands, it can make such a difference. It can change. It can change people's lives.
I always say, you know, I won't, you know, be the person who changes the world, but I think I'll have an impact on the one who does. And I think that's a kind of cool way to try and, you know, live your life. It's not so much about you've got to go and do something, but if you can be kind of authentic and share your story in a way, and inspire someone to then inspire someone to inspire someone. I mean, it's a pretty good legacy to leave, isn't it?
Yeah. We haven't very touched much on the Andy's actually the world record holder. We need to kind of emphasise that, the 10K single leg MBC. Well, I heard along the way that you wanted to break that record. Is that still going?
Yeah, you know, I want to, I think for me, I'm at the moment, I'm aiming to try and train for the Marathon des Sables, but it's proven difficult. I'm having a few issues at my stump because the Marathon des Sables at the moment, it's 80% walking as well, and I'm again much more of a runner. So I'm chopping and changing from my running blade to my normal leg, and it's given me a few issues, and it's making me actually realise how much I love running rather than fast walking, if you like. So I'm aiming on my 5K time and 10K time, and I think once that challenge is over the marathon, I'm going to concentrate on the 5K time, 5 and 10K time again, because to me, that's one of the things I'm most proud of, and it's not the title of fastest amputee in the world. That doesn't bother me whatsoever. I love the fact that, you know, most people have ran a 5 or 10K time, and most people kind of, you know, people know what it takes. You know, people have done it. Mm-hmm. So when someone says, oh, what, you're the fastest, you know, amputee 10K runner? Yeah, but how fast does an amputee run 10K? And then it's when you say 37 minutes, then they're like, oh, it's because it's not so much a disabled time anymore. It's an able-bodied time, which is quite decent, mm-hmm. isn't it? So I think that's the thing what has been most enjoyable about the 10K record. Forget the disabled aspect of it. It's the fact that, you know, you can run it in 37 minutes. I think that's, to me, what makes it more special. And that's the point when it comes to injury, that's when I kind of put the injured soldier to bed. Because when I broke that world record, I had lads who were still serving the Marines texting me saying, you know, you can run faster than me. So even though I wasn't serving alongside them anymore and I wasn't on that same career path, I still had that respect from them to say, you know what, Andy, mate, you're in better shape than me. And that to me meant everything.
Absolutely. And I know you struggled massively to adapt to civilian life. But actually, Andy, you have been recognised by, you're still and always have represented the Royal Marines, haven't you?
Yeah,
it's never left you. And you've been recognised by them with the corporal, is it the colours?
I initially got, when I broke the world record, I was given a Royal Marine vest and a Royal Marine tie, which is known as the core colours, which was massive and, you know, an unbelievable thing for the Royal Marines to do. So I definitely feel part of the Royal Marine family. And then after I wrote my book, someone in the Marines read the book and actually put me forward for an honorary colonel. So I spent the last year, you know, making everyone call me Sir. I didn't really make anyone call me Sir, but yeah, it was just a nice title to have for the year as honorary colonel. So yeah, without doubt, although I'm not technically a Marine anymore, I definitely feel very much part of the Royal Marine family.
They've just sent you something else as well, haven't they? What was the thing you got the other day?
So my year as an honorary colonel kind of come to an end. Okay. And they sent me a kind of like a gizzard, they call it, like, and it's a bit of a thank you from the Royal Marines just to say basically that, you know, thanks for representing the Marines in the way you have. And yeah, just a really nice touch. And again, just makes it feel like, you know, yeah, I'm still part of the family.
So your career didn't truly end. You got an active life, more than active life, climbing mountains, running marathons and triathlons and surfing and whatever, you know, whatever else. And you've got your beautiful daughter, Alba, who I just adore.
She's 9 now, and it was, yeah, through the miracle of IVF. It was really, really fortunate that it worked the first time. And yeah, I mean, she is the one thing in my life now that makes it all worthwhile. You know, when people say to me, you know, if you knew what you knew then, would you still join? And everything's a yes. You know, Alba for me is she's the thing that makes it all worthwhile. I'm very fortunate. We've got an amazing relationship. Me and her mum aren't together no more, but we're more like best friends now. I see her pretty much every day. We've got a great relationship. And I'm just feel like the luckiest person in the world. It's really close bonds. And yeah, she's just, I mean, I know everyone says that their kids are perfect, but yeah, to me she's just amazing, and just feel very lucky that it's all worked out well in the end.
It's absolutely fantastic, and I love the fact you do remind me. I was on my own with my daughters for a while. I think I sent you a couple of messages when I happened to be in Portugal with Hannah, just the two of us, because we've promised to keep that up. And Patrick's in our life now a bit massively, but and we do go on holiday as a family, but Hannah and I have kept up this just the two of us thing. And when I look at the two of you, it does remind me. And that bond of traveling together, it's just the memories that you're making. I'm getting teary myself now, because I've done the same with my daughter, who's now 21. And she's like, when are we going on holiday, Mum? You know, where are we going?
Yeah, no, it's so important. Like I said, I've got my partner now, and it's funny, like, you know, her mum and her partner and me and my partner, we're all kind of get on great and stuff. And we go on family holidays and stuff, which is great. But like you say, you know, always making time, just me and her, to do things. And we have our own little rituals, our own little day trips and stuff like that, and holidays. And yeah, just really keen on hopefully being a good dad for her and letting her grow up and knowing that, you know, what we said before, the message that I try and get across in the schools, I want her to grow up seeing what a dad's been through and knowing that, you know, if I can do it, then so can she. And she, you know, she's really bright and intelligent, and hopefully she can kind of, you know, have that desire to want to push it the way I have and really, you know, make something of herself.
What an inspiration. Patrick, have you got any, I'm sure that we could be here all day, but I'm conscious of Andy's time.
Oh,
I was going to say, and to top it off, your mates with Liverpool legend, Jamie Carragher, who you met in your red undies. I mean, there was only one way to go, wasn't there?
Yeah, you know what, he's been great. Yeah, I mean, in the early days, you know, I've obviously been in Afghanistan for, I think, 4 or 5 months, and then was in hospital for 3 months, and then when I finally got left home for the weekend, we obviously from the same area, and I know his in-laws, and they kind of sent him round to my house, at which point I was lying in my red undies on the couch, and he come in, and you know, I'm, you know, in shock and awe. He's in his heyday, like, this is 2009, and the fact that he come to pay me a visit was amazing. And in those early days, just a massive boost to think that, you know, Jamie Carragher knows who I am, if you like, when I'm going through that recovery process. And in the years that followed, he's became a good friend, and, you know, supported me in loads of ways and stuff. And he wrote the foreword in my book, and he's gave me stuff to raffle off to raise money for charity, and just became a mate who you can kind of go for a beer with, type thing. So it's been a crazy journey and stuff, that little things like that, you know, even though we're mates, I still get a bit, you know, bit in awe of him, if you like, when I see him. So it's that was one of the nicer things that have come along the way with getting blown up.
Yeah.
It seems that all your mates are still at the top of their game, Andy, because I had to check yesterday, and Ronnie O'Sullivan is still snooker world number one.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it sounds like I'm bloody mates with all these A-list. It's definitely not like that. And Ronnie was a great one. It was my old running coach who put me in touch with Ronnie, as Ronnie loves running. And it was actually a really nice story. Actually, the we got to go down to see Ronnie, and I think it was his agent or his manager or someone said, oh yeah, you can kind of have 20 minutes with him or something. And so we were just obviously just really grateful to even get, you know, 10, 20 minutes. And then once we got chatting, and I think Ronnie then realised how much I loved running. And I think we ended up chatting for about an hour, and then I jumped in his car and he kind of run me around a good running route down by his house. And then when he's up in London, we've been on a few runs together and stuff. And it's, I think that was just down to our love of running together. And he's obviously, I think he puts running down to a massive help in his mental health and what kept his snooker kind of, you know, like you say, he's still number one now. And that's what the funny thing's been with my recovery, really. I've ended up in just some weird situations where you just think, you know, I was a lad from Bootle, ended up in a room with this person or that person. And it's, like I say, I wouldn't change it in a way for Alba, but I also wouldn't change it anyway, because it's, despite the downs, there's been some really funny, unique things that have happened that, you know, would never have happened otherwise as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And I can't leave without mentioning, are you getting another dog?
I know everyone always says
Otto, and again, the power of dogs. I think I said to Patrick, I'm going to just do a dog podcast because they're just the best. That's all I want to talk about is dogs.
Well, we touched on it before, you know, some of the kind of down times that I had, and one of them, that was one of the reasons why I got a dog, because I'd come out with the Marines, again, drinking too much, gambling too much, and just felt like my life wasn't really going anywhere, and just wasn't in a good way. And I got a dog, and straight away that dog just gave me routine, responsibility and purpose. You know, the walks turned into longer walks turned into runs, and before you know it, you know, you and this dog have just developed this amazing bond, and you're going up bloody mountains together, running on the beach together, and it just becomes such a massive part of your life. And then obviously he passed away after 10 years, broke my heart completely. And I'm at a point now where, selfishly, I don't want to put myself through that again, because it was absolutely horrible. And also, I love traveling as well, which is selfish. Yeah. I love being able to, at the drop of a hat, go somewhere, and especially, like you said, like me and my daughter. And as you know, dogs are huge commitments, and it's, I don't want to get a dog and not be there for it. So it's, I think maybe when a couple more years, I don't know. One day I want to get one, I think no. So,
and I'll be honest with you, the one reason I've never bought one of them bloody machines is because of what happened with your dog.
Oh, the Hoover.
Those Hoovers, and it spread his little accidents all over your lovely part, all over your wooden floors.
Every now and again,
it was one of the funniest social media clips I've ever seen.
Yeah, every now and again I go on Twitter, and I think if you type in like Andy G Bootneck Hoover, I think it comes up straight away. So every now and again I'll show someone the video of it. It's crazy. Yeah.
Nice, lovely, lovely fun memory though. And maybe probably not the best thing to end on, given the story that we
people can just go and watch that video on Twitter now and see what they mean. But yeah, don't ever buy a remote control Hoover when you've got a dog that does a shit in the middle of the night. We're just leaving it at that.
That's great. Great note to end on. Andy, you are the absolutely epitome of talk on to walk on. I mean, you know, what an absolute honor to, I know you have told your story a lot of times, and it is, and but I do advocate people getting the book and reading it in far more detail, because it's so brilliantly written. It's a great read, and it's a massive inspiration and life lesson. Like Jamie says, you know, I know he quotes you when his kids are getting on his nerves and stuff, and definitely one for mid to late teens or an upwards. And they can find you in terms of people want to book you for your talks. What's the best way to get hold of you?
Yeah, so my email is andygrantmotivation@gmail.com, or if they message on, you know, Instagram or Twitter, you can normally get me on there.
And your podcast as well. We haven't even talked about that.
Yeah, no, the podcast is just a bit of a hobby, really. Just we do a sports show every Friday. It's called the Legged Podcast, so might be for you. But I just want to say as well, massive thanks to you guys as well. I haven't really done any podcasts for a while, but that was really, really enjoyable. Probably one of the best ones I've done. How it was, some really good topics in there, the way you went through it. Yeah, most enjoyable one I've done, so thank you.
Oh, that's a real compliment coming from you. I was a bit nervous, actually, because I was like, oh, God, he's the podcast king there.
Yeah, really brilliant.
Are we going to how many cups are we going to win, Andy, before our hero leaves us and we all cry and go in a dark room?
I think we're definitely in the league. I think we're definitely getting two. I think, probably the League Cup and the league. I'd say I'd take them two now.
Big weekend for us.
Massive, yeah. I was at the Chelsea game.
Yeah.
I thought that was the best 45 minutes of football I've ever seen. It was unbelievable.
I was at it and you were just messaging me going, oh my God, this game, this team. And I was like, I was just kept saying, Connor Bradley.
Yeah. Incredible. So I'm going up to Scotland on it in the morning. Like I say, we're having a big party Saturday night for the 15 years. And then it's a case of waking up, racing home and getting to the pub for R4 for the big game on Sunday. And I think if we can win that, I think it's real momentum, isn't it, going into the last, 15 games.
It helps that we got City at home.
I think if you've got to go to City in the kind of March, April, it's a bit tougher. The fact that they're coming here in March, I think that's massive.
Andy, have a great celebration. I bet you never thought 15 years ago when you were lying in that ditch, you'd be having a party 15 years later, actually celebrating. Oh, you're a star, Andy. Thank you so much. Have a great time this weekend. So deserved.
Thanks
for your advice. Take care.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed listening to our Talk On To Walk On podcast and you want to know more about our coaching, mentoring and talks offer, then go to our website, talkontowalkon.com. We would love to talk to you about how we can share our many life lessons so you, your team or your students can walk on in life with confidence. If you're listening to the audio version of our podcast, don't forget you can also watch full episodes and view highlights on our YouTube channel. Obviously, if you'd like to sponsor our podcast, we would also love to hear from you. So let's connect, have a conversation, and you never know where it will lead.